We evaluate that behavior, like cheating, and feel guilt when the behavior is inconsistent with who we want to be. Shame is focusing on who we are rather than what we've done. The danger of telling ourselves that we are bad, a cheat, and no good is that we eventually start to believe it and own it. The person who believes she is no good is much more likely to continue to cheat and fulfill that label than the person who feels guilt. Along with many other shame researchers, I have come to the conclusion that shame is much more likely to be the source of destructive behaviors than it is to be the solution. It is human nature to want to feel affirmed and valued. When we experience shame, we feel disconnected and desperate for belonging and recognition. It's when we feel shame or the fear of shame that we are more likely to engage in self-destructive behaviors, to attack or humiliate others, or to stay quiet when we see someone who needs our help. On the other hand, when we apologize for something we've done, make amends to others, or change behavior that we don't feel good about, guilt is most often the motivator. Recognizing we've made a mistake is far different than believing we are a mistake. Of course you can shame someone into saying, "I'm sorry," but it's rarely authentic. I'm often asked if the same experience can cause shame for one person and guilt or embarrassment for someone else. The answer is yes. This is why we need to be careful not to make assumptions about what causes people to feel shame. To illustrate, I'll use a fairly innocuous example, remembering someone's birthday. There have been times in my life when forgetting someone's birthday, especially that of a family member or a close friend, has really made me feel embarrassed. I can't believe I forgot to do that. I recovered quickly with a simple phone call. "I'm so embarrassed I forgot your birthday. I hope you had a great one." There have been other times in my life where I have felt very guilty about forgetting someone's birthday, because it wasn't simply an oversight or a slip-up. It reflected a lack of priorities that I didn't feel good about and wanted to change. However, following my return to work after I had my daughter Ellen, small things like forgetting to send a birthday card or to call to RSVP for a party would elicit very strong feelings of shame in me. I would sometimes find myself fabricating huge lies about why I had forgotten to call or send a gift. During that time in my life, I felt like everything I did was half-assed. I felt like I was a mediocre faculty member, a mediocre mother and partner, a mediocre friend, and a mediocre sister and daughter. So when I did do something like forget a birthday, I would feel like, "Oh man, I can't believe I forgot to do that." I would say, "God, I am so stupid. I can't do anything right." Ellen is now 7, and I've recently returned to work after spending several months at home with my second baby, Charlie. I still struggle with remembering birthdays and feeling overwhelmed and mediocre at times, but I've worked my way back to guilt. I've decided that remembering birthdays is important to me. However, I've also acknowledged that balancing work and parenting requires lots of flexibility and advanced planning. Now I stock up on belated birthday cards as well as the regular kind. So, as you can see, we can experience embarrassment, guilt, or shame over the same situations. It just depends on where we are in our lives. Humiliation is another word that we often confuse with shame. Donald Klein captures the differences between shame and humiliation when he writes, "People believe they deserve their shame. They do not believe they deserve their humiliation." If you go back to the initial definitions given by the research participants, you can see that one of the themes that runs through several of the definitions is this concept of deserving. One woman said, "Shame is hating yourself and understanding why other people hate you too." Another woman actually used the term deserve and said, "Shame is like a prison, but a prison that you deserve to be in because something's wrong with you." Let me give you an example of the difference between shame and humiliation from my recent research on how shame is used to parent and teach. If a teacher announces a child's failing grade in front of the class and calls him stupid, the child is likely to experience shame or humiliation. If the child believes the teacher's announcement and name-calling is unfair and undeserved, the child will most likely feel humiliated rather than ashamed. If, on the other hand, the child buys into the message that he is stupid and deserves to be called out in front of his peers, that leads to shame. Based on the research I'm conducting on the impact of using shame to parent and discipline in schools, I think shame is often more destructive than humiliation for two reasons. First, it's bad enough to have a child labeled stupid at school, but it's far more detrimental if the child actually believes she is stupid. If a child is shamed into believing that he or she is stupid, the child is potentially being set up for a lifetime of struggle. Second, I'm finding that the child who experiences humiliation rather than shame is much more likely to come home and tell a parent or caregiver about her experience than the child who experiences shame. In this case, if our child tells us about her humiliating experience, we have the opportunity to help her feel her way through it and address it with teachers and school administrators. The child who feels shame internalizes the messages and often starts to act out or shut down. Of course, we need to understand that repeated humiliation can often turn into shame. If someone a child looks up to, like a teacher or a parent, repeatedly calls that child stupid, chances are that he will eventually believe it. In fact, all of us are very susceptible to having our humiliating experiences turn to shame, especially when the person who is putting us down is someone with whom we have a valued relationship, or someone whom we perceive to have more power than we do, like a boss, a doctor, or a member of the clergy. Once we can distinguish among embarrassment, guilt, shame, and humiliation, we can begin to look at why we experience shame and how it affects us. Understanding the how and why of shame is critically important because there is far more to shame resilience than surviving a shaming moment. If we want to successfully deal with the shame in our lives, we have to understand why we feel it and how it affects our lives, including the behaviors, thoughts, and feelings we deal with every day. The shame web. In the years I have spent immersed in this research, one of the most difficult questions to answer has been, what is the connection among all of these women's shame experiences? The women who participated in the study were very diverse in terms of race, ethnicity, age, sexual orientation, religion, faith affiliations, physical and mental health characteristics, and family roles. Approximately 41% of the women identified themselves as Caucasian, 26% of the women as African American, 25% as Latina, and 8% as Asian American. The participants' ages ranged from 18 to 82, and the average was approximately 40. As I read through the interviews, analyzing all of their stories and experiences, I searched for connections. Clearly, what triggers shame in some of us has no impact on others. What some of us experience as devastating may feel mildly upsetting to others. Yet when you read the descriptions and hear the stories of hundreds of women, it's very clear that there is something central in everyone's experience of shame. Here is what I found. Women most often experience shame as a web of layered, conflicting, and competing social community expectations. These expectations dictate who we should be, what we should be, how we should be. Once entangled in the web, women feel flooded with feelings of fear, blame, and disconnection. I think it's safe to say that each of these three concepts alone is overwhelming, but if we understand fear, blame, and disconnection as intricately woven together to create shame, it becomes very clear why shame is so powerful, complex, and difficult to overcome. The expectations that form the web are often based on characteristics like our race, class, sexual orientation, age, or religious identity. They can be specific to the different roles we play, like mother, employee, partner, sister, or member of a certain group. But at their core, the expectations that fuel shame are specifically about what is expected of us as women. Shame is organized by gender. The expectations that fuel shame for women are based on our culture's perception of what is acceptable for women. In my new research on men, I'm learning that the expectations that fuel shame for men are based on our culture's perception of masculinity. What should a man be, look like, and act like? Although these gender-based expectations are often born in our larger society, they can filter through our various communities in different ways. That is why I call them social community expectations. For example, there are broad social expectations for women around the issue of appearance. We are expected to be young, beautiful, sexy, etc. However, in my community, there are no expectations about hair texture or skin color, whereas in some communities this can be an issue. I recently received a letter from one woman who wrote, "As a dark-skinned African-American woman raising multiracial children, I have experienced painful encounters regarding race, skin color, and beauty standards within the African-American community. Your work gives words and validation to the feelings that wash over me during those uncomfortable times when I am faced with explaining to my children that beauty is in everyone, regardless of skin color, eye color, or hair texture." Another example might be mental health. There are general social expectations that only a certain level of crazy is tolerated or socially acceptable. However, in some communities, it can be shaming to take any mental health problems outside of the family, whereas in other communities, everyone has a therapist. It is important to note that our communities are not just determined by geography. Most of us belong to communities based on larger issues like race, ethnicity, social class, group membership, ideology, faith, politics, etc. Shame and fear. Shame is all about fear. As I wrote in the introduction, we are biologically, emotionally, socially, and cognitively wired for connection. For many, there is also a deep need for spiritual connection. Shame is about the fear of disconnection. When we are experiencing shame, we are steeped in the fear of being ridiculed, diminished, or seen as flawed. We are afraid that we've exposed or revealed a part of us that jeopardizes our connection and our worthiness of acceptance. This fear is fueled by the sense that we are somehow trapped in our shame. This fear of being trapped relates to the way in which the shame web is baited with an impossible ratio of expectations and options. First, we have an unreasonable number of expectations put upon us, many of which are not even attainable or realistic. Second, we have a very limited number of options in terms of how we can meet those expectations. To bring the image of the shame web into focus, let's use an example that most of us find relevant: body image. Even with all our awareness about media manipulation and eating disorders, this issue just does not seem to be getting better. In fact, body image and weight emerged as a shame issue in approximately 90% of the women I interviewed. As you can see on the web illustration, partners, family, friends, and self are drawn closest to the center of the web. We most fear disconnection from the people closest to us. In other words, shame is the most powerful when we enforce the expectation ourselves, or when it's enforced by those closest to us, our partners, our family, or friends. Radiating from the center, we have helping professionals, doctors, therapists, etc., community members, membership groups, educators, colleagues, and faith communities. If we were raised in families in which unattainable body types were highly valued, we might continue to impose that unreasonable expectation on ourselves, even if we have found a partner who accepts us for who we are and who wants desperately for us to feel comfortable with our bodies. In other instances, our partners may enforce strict expectations, but our friends may either offer support or think less of us because we appear overly concerned about dieting. But even in the face of these opposing expectations, we all still want to be accepted and loved by these groups. So we struggle to find ways to please them all, and then feel shame when we ultimately fail to meet the competing demands. When it comes to the outer layers of the web, we may feel shamed by doctors, colleagues, or fellow group members. And beyond these groups, there are even larger, more insidious systemic issues that we have to confront. For example, research shows that overweight and obese women have lower incomes, $6,700 a year less, and higher rates of poverty, 10% higher, than their non-obese peers. If you look at the perimeter of the shame web, you'll see the media. The culture of shame is reinforced by what we see on television, in advertising and marketing. It's what we see in movies, what we hear in music, and what we read in newspapers and magazines. When it comes to body image, there's no question about the value of thin. To make matters worse, as the waif look and heroin chic are recycled in yesterday's fashion magazines, the new ideal body is still tiny, except for a round, voluptuous bottom and huge breasts. This combination is not something that occurs very often in nature. The bone-thin, big booty and boobs combo is more often a carved-to-order package. Regardless of how hard we try to dodge the influence of the media, in our society we cannot escape it. Jean Kilbourne, one of my favorite researchers and writers, is an expert in helping us identify and deconstruct media messages, even the more subtle ones. According to her book, Can't Buy Me Love, How Advertising Changes the Way We Think and Feel, the average American is exposed to more than 3,000 advertisements a day and watches 3 years' worth of television ads over the course of a lifetime. Trying to escape media influences in today's culture is as feasible as trying to protect ourselves from air pollution by not breathing. Kilbourne also decodes the competing messages that grace the covers of women's magazines. She points out how the covers are usually plastered with catchy headlines like, "Lose 15 pounds in 10 days," or "How to get healthy and lighten up by summer." However, the pictures that go along with these taglines never quite fit. The "Lose Weight Now" slogan hangs over a double chocolate mousse cake, rather than a 175-pound woman sweating her butt off on a treadmill. So while we're lightening up for summer, we need to make time to whip up that dessert of the month and have a slice or two. And as Kilbourne points out, the back of that same magazine probably features a cigarette advertisement that associates smoking with being slim. It's easy to see how quickly expectations become layered, competitive, and conflicting. This is how the shame web works. We have very few realistic options that allow us to meet any of these expectations. Most of the options that we do have feel like a double bind. Writer Marilyn Fry describes a double bind as a situation in which options are very limited and all of them expose us to penalty, censure, or deprivation. When our options are limited, every choice violates another expectation. Often we feel forced to choose between bad or worse. Be thin, but don't be weight obsessed. Be perfect, but don't make a fuss about your looks. And don't take time away from anything like your family or your partner or your work to achieve your perfection. Just quietly make it happen in the background so you look great and we don't have to hear about it. Just be yourself. There's nothing sexier than self-confidence, as long as you're young, thin, beautiful. If we can't pull it all off, lose the weight, bake and eat the cake, smoke the cigarettes and look cool, stay healthy and fit, buy all the products, and at the same time, love ourselves for who we are. Gotcha. We get trapped in the shame web. That's when our fear starts to turn to blame and disconnection. Shame, blame, and power. When we are feeling shame and fear, blame is never far behind. Sometimes we turn inward and blame ourselves, and other times we strike out and blame others. When we blame ourselves, we often find ourselves in a cycle of self-loathing and shame. Quietly, we emotionally implode. When we try to get out from underneath the pain of shame and fear by blaming others, we often explode. We lash out at our child, our employee, our partner, or maybe even the customer service person standing in front of us. We'll explore the relationship between blame and anger in Chapter 8. Either way, imploding or exploding, we are mostly unaware of what we are doing and why we are doing it. We use blame to deal with our feelings of powerlessness. Power is a difficult topic for women. The majority of women I talk to are uncomfortable with the idea of a powerful woman. Many of them quickly associated the concept of a powerful woman with being unliked or being a bitch. On the other hand, every woman I interviewed was quick to acknowledge how scary and desperate it feels to be powerless. This ambivalence about power poses a serious threat to our ability to be our best selves. One of the issues that fuels our uncertainty about power is the fact that there are at least two forms of power. I call them power over and real power. Unfortunately, when most of us hear the word power, we automatically jump to the concept of power over. The idea that power is the ability to control people, take advantage of others, or exert force over somebody or something. We think of power as finite. There's only so much. So if I'm going to get some, I'm forced to take it away from you. Power over is a dangerous form of power. Dr. Robin Smith, a psychologist and contributor to The Oprah Winfrey Show, described one of the most insidious forms of power over as working like this. I will define who you are, and then I'll make you believe that's your own definition. This chilling explanation of power over captures what shame does to us. It forces us into gender straitjackets, then convinces us that we put them on ourselves and that we enjoy wearing them. Over the past year, I've seen a potent example of power over at work. I speak to many groups about shame and body image. When Dove's Campaign for Real Beauty was launched a couple of years ago, I asked women how they felt about seeing real women in their panties and bras versus super thin models. I was not surprised to hear half the women say they didn't like it. Many described their reaction this way. I know it's probably a great thing, but I had a very negative emotional reaction when I saw it. Some women felt embarrassed for the models, and others said, it doesn't inspire me to look better or lose weight. Basically, what I heard 2 years ago is what I still hear from women today. I know it's empowering and wonderful, but my gut reaction is, you're too fat and not perfect enough. Put some clothes on. It's important to understand that most of the women who struggle with their emotional reaction to the Dove models look like the Dove models. This is power over at work. Right in line with Dr. Smith's definition, beauty has been defined for us so often and in such insidious ways that we now support and buy into the definition as if it were our own. The result is disastrous. We don't want to see ourselves reflected back to us in magazines because we're not perfect, thin, or beautiful enough to be valued. Ironically, the only way to free ourselves from power over is to reclaim our real power, the power to create and live by our own definitions. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines power as the ability to act or produce an effect. Real power is basically the ability to change something if you want to change it. It's the ability to make change happen. Real power is unlimited. We don't need to fight over it because there is plenty to go around. And the great thing about real power is our ability to create it. Real power doesn't force us to take it away from others. It's something we create and build with others. When we talk about shame and powerlessness, we're really talking about three specific components of real power: consciousness, choice, and change. In order to effectively make changes and address the problems in our lives, we need to first be conscious or aware of the problem. Second, we need to be able to problem solve and identify the choices we can make to address the problem. Once we are aware of the problem and our options for dealing with it, we need to be able to facilitate change. We need to be able to act on those choices. This is a great place to introduce Jillian. I interviewed Jillian in 2002 and then again in 2005. I'll tell you about our first meeting now. Later in the book, you'll learn how Jillian's life changed as she started building shame resilience. This story illustrates the way shame floods us with intense feelings of fear and blame. In our first interview, Jillian told me about a recent shame experience that had her believing she was losing it. Jillian had been enjoying an unusually relaxing Saturday with her two kids and her husband, Scott. Jillian and Scott were sitting on the patio while her kids played in the backyard. She was going through the week's mail when she came across a birthday invitation addressed to her 5-year-old. As she started reading it, she was overcome with emotion, emotions that she described as a terrible combination of fear, anger, and anxiety. She described her reaction to the emotional flooding. "I swear, out of nowhere, I stood up and started yelling at my kids for being too loud and tearing into my husband for keeping the garage so messy. I ran into the house and slammed my bedroom door. Scott followed her into the house and stood outside the door, jiggling the locked doorknob. She told me he just kept saying, 'Jesus Christ, Jillian, what is wrong with you? Have you lost your frickin' mind?' When I asked Jillian what had triggered the emotional flood, she said, 'I really didn't know for days. I kept thinking I was going crazy, because it wasn't the first time. I finally figured out that the invitation was for a pool party, and it said that parents have to swim with their kids.' Jillian explained that she had terrible shame about being in a swimsuit in front of the perfect skinny moms. She said, 'Sometimes when I feel ashamed, I get fearful and I just go nuts. I feel so lost, I don't even know what's happening.' As Jillian and I continued to talk about her reaction to the birthday invitation and her fear of being in a swimsuit in front of the perfect moms, she explained how she'd always been uncomfortable with her body, but since she had gained weight after her pregnancies, she had become very self-conscious. When I asked her to tell me more about motherhood and body image, she began to shake her head and said, 'I can't believe it.' She explained that she had flipped through a fashion magazine while she was waiting to get her hair cut, and there was a big spread featuring supermodels on the beach with their kids. She started reading it, and one of the models was quoted as saying, 'Just because I'm a mom doesn't mean I can let myself go. Kids don't want frumpy fat mothers. My kids are proud of how I look.' Jillian looked surprised as she told me about the magazine. 'I didn't even realize how that has stuck with me. Of course, a magazine alone might not trigger strong feelings of shame if we aren't already vulnerable. But combine those pictures with that quote and the body image issues most of us struggle with, and you have a very powerful combination. It's clear in this example that Jillian felt fearful, trapped, and powerless. When we experience shame, it is very difficult to maintain our power. First, when we feel shame, most of us are not conscious of what we're feeling and why we're feeling it. Shame often produces overwhelming and painful feelings of confusion, fear, anger, judgment, and/or the need to escape or hide from the situation. It's difficult to identify shame as the core issue when we're trying to manage all these very intense feelings. In their interviews, many women described the feelings of powerlessness that often overcome us in shaming moments. Shame is that feeling that comes over you like a hot wave, and the minute it comes over you, you think to yourself, 'Oh my God, where can I hide? How can I disappear?' Shame is the feeling you get when you believe that you're not worthy of anyone caring about you or loving you, that you're such a bad person that you can't even blame other people for not caring about you. You just want the floor to swallow you up. Shame freezes me. I totally lose my ability to respond. All of a sudden, everything goes dark, and you're stuck. You don't know what's happening, and you don't know what to do. I just go away. I'm never ugly to people. I just disappear. If someone thinks I'm that bad, I'll just make myself invisible, so no one has to deal with me. One time I stopped to get gas, and my credit card was declined. The guy gave me a really hard time. As I pulled out of the station, my 3-year-old son started crying. I just started screaming, 'Shut up, shut up, shut up!' I was so ashamed about my card. I went nuts. Then I was ashamed that I yelled at my son. When we are experiencing shame, we are often thrown into crisis mode. Most of the time, we can barely handle all of the byproducts of shame, the fear, blame, and disconnection. In fact, there's new brain research that is helping us understand that shame can be so threatening that rather than processing it in the neocortex, the advanced part of the brain that allows us to think, analyze, and react, shame can signal our brains to go into our very primal fight, flight, or freeze mode. In this mode, the neocortex is bypassed, and our access to advanced rational calm thinking and processing of emotion all but disappears. The primitive part of the brain springs into action, and that's when we find ourselves becoming aggressive, wanting to run and hide, or feeling paralyzed, sometimes without any clue as to why. The good news is that by practicing shame resilience, we can actually change this response. We'll discuss this more in Chapter 3. Shame and disconnection. If feeling connected is feeling valued, accepted, worthy, and affirmed, then feeling disconnected is feeling diminished, rejected, unworthy, and reduced. When I asked Jillian why she didn't want to wear a swimsuit in front of her friends, the first thing she said was, "I don't want to be put down or criticized. I cringe when I think of them talking about how I look behind my back. I just couldn't handle it." When I asked her if she thought they would care how she looked, she thought about it for a minute and said, "Probably not. I just can't risk being hurt like that. I'd feel totally alone." While dealing with shame and feelings of disconnection can be a normal part of developing and growing relationships, disconnection can become more serious when it turns into feelings of isolation. When I talk about isolation, I don't mean feeling lonely or alone. Jean Baker Miller and Irene Stiver, relational cultural theorists from the Stone Center at Wellesley College, have beautifully captured the overwhelming nature of isolation. They write, "We believe that the most terrifying and destructive feeling that a person can experience is psychological isolation. This is not the same as being alone. It is a feeling that one is locked out of the possibility of human connection and of being powerless to change the situation. In the extreme, psychological isolation can lead to a sense of hopelessness and desperation. People will do almost anything to escape this combination of condemned isolation and powerlessness. Shame can make us feel desperate. Reactions to this desperate need to escape from isolation and fear can run the gamut from behavioral issues and acting out to depression, self-injury, eating disorders, addiction, violence, and suicide. Personally, I've learned that when I'm experiencing shame, I often act out in ways that are inconsistent with who I want to be." Again, we see the fight, flight, or freeze behaviors. Many of the participants expressed the same sentiment in their own language. "When I feel shame, I'm like a crazy person. I do stuff and say stuff I would normally never do or say. Sometimes I wish I could make other people feel as bad as I do. I just want to lash out and scream at everyone. I get desperate when I feel shame, like I have nowhere to turn, no one to talk to. When I feel ashamed, I check out, mentally and emotionally, even with my family. Shame makes you feel estranged from the world." Using the web and the concepts of fear, blame, and disconnection, I want to expand our earlier definition to address why and how women experience shame. Here is the full definition that we'll use throughout the remainder of the book. Shame is the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing we are flawed and therefore unworthy of acceptance and belonging. Women often experience shame when they are entangled in a web of layered, conflicting, and competing social community expectations. Shame creates feelings of fear, blame, and disconnection. 2. Shame resilience and the power of empathy. How do we overcome shame? What can we do to avoid getting trapped in the shame web? The bad news is that there's no way to permanently rid ourselves of shame. As long as connection is critical, the threat of disconnection that leads to shame will also be a part of our lives. The good news, however, is that we are all capable of developing shame resilience. Again, by resilience, I mean that ability to recognize shame when we experience it and move through it in a constructive way that allows us to maintain our authenticity and grow from our experiences. And in this process of consciously moving through our shame, we can build stronger and more meaningful connections with the people in our lives. In the same way we built an understanding of shame using definitions and descriptions, we have to build an understanding of resilience. First, shame resilience is not an all-or-nothing proposition. There are degrees of resilience. To illustrate this, I developed the shame resilience continuum. On the left-hand side of that continuum is shame. Under shame are the byproducts of shame: fear, blame, and disconnection. In order to get to courage, compassion, and connection, we have to discover what moves us away from shame toward resilience. To do that, we go back to the interviews with the women about their experiences of shame. Many of the women I interviewed shared their ideas and strategies for overcoming shame. I analyzed this information by asking, what is it that allows women to develop resilience to shame? How did they move away from feeling fearful, blaming, and disconnected? What enabled women to work their way out of shame? Over and over, the women I interviewed explained how empathy is the strongest antidote for shame. It's not just about having our needs for empathy met. Shame resilience requires us to be able to respond empathetically to others. Women with high levels of shame resilience were both givers and receivers of empathy. Do you remember the Petri dishes from high school science lab? Those little round dishes? If you put shame in a Petri dish and covered it with judgment, silence, and secrecy, it grows out of control until it consumes everything in sight. You have basically provided shame with the environment it needs to thrive. On the other hand, if you put shame in a Petri dish and douse it with empathy, shame loses power and starts to fade. Empathy creates a hostile environment for shame. It can't survive. When I asked women to share examples of how they recovered from shame, they described situations in which they were able to talk about their shame with someone who expressed empathy. Women talked about the power of hearing someone say, "I understand. I've been there. That's happened to me too. It's okay. You're normal. I understand what that's like." Like shame itself, the stories of resilience shared a common core. When it comes to shame resilience, empathy is at the center. Empathy, easier said than done. Real empathy takes more than words. It takes work. Empathy is not simply knowing the right thing to say to someone who is experiencing shame. Our words are only as effective as our ability to be genuinely present and engaged with someone as she tells her story. I define empathy as the skill or ability to tap into our own experiences in order to connect with an experience someone is relating to us. Another definition I like comes from a counseling textbook written by Arne Ivey, Paul Pedersen, and Mary Ivey. They describe empathy as the ability to perceive a situation from the other person's perspective, to see, hear, and feel the unique world of the other. I believe that empathy is best understood as a skill because being empathetic, or having the capacity to show empathy, is not a quality that is innate or intuitive. We might be naturally sensitive to others, but there is more to empathy than sensitivity. Here's an example of how my friend Dawn's empathic response helped me through a difficult, shaming moment. Every now and then, maybe 3 times a year, my worlds collide. They aren't small schedule conflicts, they are major collisions involving almost every one of my roles. One weekend in May, a couple of years ago, I had one of those collisions. My daughter was having her first ballet recital on the same weekend as the university commencement ceremony. The graduation ceremony and ballet recital overlapped by 2 hours. This was a huge stressor because I had been elected by the students to play an important role in the graduation ceremony. In addition to graduation and the ballet recital, that Sunday was Mother's Day, and my entire family and my husband Steve's family were coming in from out of town for the festivities. The Friday leading into this monster weekend was my last day of teaching for the spring semester and Ellen's last day of school. For me, the last day means turning in the grades for my students. For Ellen, it means Teacher Appreciation Day. Steve and I had signed up to bring cookies for the Teacher Appreciation Party. In the midst of turning in grades, attending commencement practice, ballet dress rehearsal, and getting the house ready for company, the cookies slipped my mind. Steve had dropped off Ellen on Friday morning, and when I arrived to pick her up from school, the party sign-in sheet was still hanging on the front door. As I looked down and saw my name next to dessert, I panicked. I really liked and respected Ellen's teachers. How could I have done this? I quickly cased the joint and decided to slink in, grab Ellen, and sneak out undetected. But as I was making my way down the hall, I came face to face with Ellen's teacher. I immediately went into my nervous high voice mode. "Hi, how are you? How was the party?" Ellen's teacher said, "Great, thanks. It was really fun. The food was great." Oh no, why did she say something about the food? She must know. I descended from high voice to liar mode. I said, "So, did Steve bring the cookies this morning?" Ellen's teacher looked puzzled and said, "I'm not sure. I wasn't here when he dropped her off." So I stood on my tippy toes, like I was looking over her shoulder, pointed my finger toward the back of the classroom, pretended like I was scanning the food table, and said, "Oh, there they are, right there. Yum, they look great. Great. I'm so glad he brought them on time." She looked at me kindly yet knowingly and said, "I'll see you in a couple of weeks when the summer session starts. Have a good break." I got Ellen, literally slithered back to the car, buckled Ellen in her car seat, sat in the front seat, and tears just started pouring down my cheeks. As I sat there, clinging to the steering wheel, I didn't know which was worse, that I had forgotten the cookies, that I had lied about bringing cookies, or the shame of knowing Ellen's teacher must have been thinking, "Man, that was the worst working mom shuffle I've ever seen." Ellen looked a little worried, so I kept telling her, "It's okay. Mommy has a little cry in her. It's no big deal." I cried all the way home. As soon as I got in the door, I called my friend Dawn. She answered, a la caller ID. "What's up?" I confessed quietly and quickly. "I just stole cookies from some parent at Ellen's school, then I lied to the teacher." Without skipping a beat, she said, "What kind of cookies?" I replied, "No, really, listen to what I did." She stopped joking around and listened. When I was done, she said, "Look, you're doing the best you can. You have an impossible weekend in front of you. You're just trying to hold it together, and you don't want Ellen's teacher to think you don't appreciate her. That's pretty understandable, given the fact that you like her and she's great with Ellen. It's not a big deal." I kept asking, "Are you sure? Are you sure?" She finally said, "Look, I know you don't think you're going to hold it together for the next 3 days, but you will. You may not do it perfectly, but you're going to do it. I know that was probably really hard for you, but we've all been there, and it's really okay." In that split second, the shame turned into something else, something I could handle, something that moved away from, "I'm so stupid, I'm a terrible mother," to, "That was pretty stupid, I'm an overwhelmed mother." She dropped just enough empathy in my petri dish to make it start fading away. She wasn't judgmental. She didn't make me feel I had to keep silent about my misstep. I really felt she had heard me and cared about me. She validated my fear of barely hanging on, and she acknowledged how much I like Ellen's teachers. Most importantly, she saw my world as I was experiencing it, and she was able to express that to me. She didn't make it okay that I lied to Ellen's teacher, but she did make me feel accepted and connected. When I'm in shame, I can't be a good partner, or a good teacher, or a good mother, or a good friend. If I had gone into that weekend feeling I was an unworthy mother and a liar who stole cookies from the mouths of babes, I wouldn't have made it. She also held back her laughter. I can laugh about it now, but when it was happening, it wasn't the least bit funny to me. She could have laughed and said, "You're making a big deal out of nothing. It's fine. Don't worry." But that would not have been empathy. That might have reflected how she felt, but it certainly would not have expressed that she knew what I was experiencing. A joking response might have left me feeling unheard, diminished, and even more ashamed because I was overreacting on top of stealing cookies. I wasn't in a place where I could have said, "Look, Dawn, I did this really terrible thing. I was just trying to hold it together, and I know I'm not perfect." I felt too fearful, trapped, and powerless. If Dawn had not extended such great empathy, I probably would have gone into the weekend feeling very disconnected. I'm sure it would have been mere hours before I blamed Steve and blindsided him with a "you have no idea how stressful my life is" fight. Not a good start to a big family weekend. Empathy education. When I was in graduate school, almost every one of my classes included a component on increasing empathy skills. This is true for most people pursuing graduate degrees in professions like psychology, social work, counseling, and marriage and family therapy. In the glowing body of empathy research, we are finding that successful leaders often demonstrate high levels of empathy, that empathy is related to academic and professional success, that it can reduce aggression and prejudice and increase altruism. Studies also show that it's a vital component in successful marriages and effective organizations. The bottom line is that empathy is essential for building meaningful, trusting relationships, which is something we all want and need. Given its power to overcome shame and its key role in building many different types of connections, empathy is something we would all be wise to learn and to practice. Fortunately, empathy is something that can be learned. Teresa Wiseman, a nursing scholar in England, identifies four defining attributes of empathy. They are: 1, to be able to see the world as others see it. 2, to be non-judgmental. 3, to understand another person's feelings. And 4, to communicate your understanding of that person's feelings. To understand the complexity of empathy, let's look at each attribute separately. By doing so, we can see how being authentically empathetic is an incredible skill, one that takes commitment and practice. To be able to see the world as others see it. Sometimes the skill of trying to see the world as others see it is called perspective taking. I find the lens metaphor a very helpful way to understand perspective taking. We all see the world through multiple lenses. These lenses represent who we are and the perspectives from which we view the world. Some of these lenses are constantly changing, and some have been with us from the day we were born. Conflict is easy to understand when we think about the lens metaphor. 20 people can witness the same event, hear the same news story, or analyze the same situation, but 20 different sets of lenses cause them all to see, hear, and deduce very different things. In order to be empathic, we must be willing to recognize and acknowledge our own lens and attempt to see the situation that someone is experiencing through her lens. For example, as a researcher, I need to understand how the world looks for the participants I interview. I must work very hard not to see their stories through my lenses, but to listen as they describe what they see, feel, and experience. In the cookie example, Dawn was able to take my perspective on the situation and respond empathically from that perspective. Children are very receptive to learning perspective-taking skills. They are naturally curious about the world and how others operate in it. They are also far less invested in their perspective being the right one. Those of us who were taught perspective-taking skills as children owe our parents a huge debt of gratitude. Those of us who were not introduced to that skill when we were younger will have to work harder to acquire it as adults. regardless of how hard we work. We are all human, and there are times when we will push other people's lives and stories in front of our own lenses, rather than honoring what they see through theirs. Unfortunately, when it comes to responding empathically to someone who is experiencing shame, we're more likely to hold on to our own perspective if we have similar shame issues. If Dawn had recently had her own mother shame experience, she might not have been able to put her lens down long enough to pick up mine. My cookie story might have hit too close to home. Over-identifying with someone's experience can be as much a barrier to perspective taking as not identifying at all. While perspective taking is not easy, it can be accomplished. It takes commitment, effort, the courage to make a lot of mistakes, and the willingness to be confronted about those mistakes. It also requires believing what we see is one view of the world, not the view. To be non-judgmental. One of the greatest challenges we will face on this path to developing empathy will be to overcome the habit of judging others. We all do it, and most of us do it all the time. Judging has become such a part of our thinking patterns that we are rarely even aware of why and how we do it. It takes a great deal of conscious thinking or mindfulness to even bring the habit of judging into our awareness. Often, our need to judge others is deeply motivated by our need to evaluate our own abilities, beliefs, and values. According to research conducted by Sidney Schrauger and Marian Patterson, judging others allows us to appraise and compare our abilities, beliefs, and values against the abilities, beliefs, and values of others. This explains why we most often judge others around the issues that are important in our lives. For example, in my interviews with women, I heard over and over how women constantly feel judged by other women when it comes to appearance and motherhood. On the other hand, every man I interviewed talked about how other men are constantly sizing up each other's level of financial success, intellectual and physical strength, as measures of power. Sometimes, when suffocating under our culture's rigid gender ideals, we mistakenly believe we can escape the pressure by judging others. Look, compared to her, I'm great. Shame, fear, and anxiety are all major incubators of judgment. When we are in our own shame about an issue, or when we are feeling anxious, threatened, or fearful about an issue, refraining from judgment can seem impossible. In my interviews, there were three topics that consistently elicited painfully harsh judgments on the part of the participants. Surprisingly, they were not abortion, politics, religion, or any of the big issues of the day. They were the issues that hit closest to home: addiction, parenting, and affairs. In other areas, women felt remorse about being so judgmental toward others, but when it came to these issues, women felt absolutely justified in their angry judgments. For example, I was talking to one woman who was telling me how shaming it is for her when her parents criticize the way she raises her kids. She told me, "When it comes to parenting, everyone is a critic. Very few people ever tell you what you do well. They just find fault in everything you do." She explained how she was working with a parenting coach and reading books and working really hard, and that she'd just like someone to acknowledge how hard she's trying. Then she went on to say, "Here's the thing. I work very hard to be a good parent. I try not to get angry and yell. I try not to lose my patience. When I do lose it and get angry, I feel really bad. I never hit or say hateful things, but sometimes I get angry. I work really hard to be a good mom. If you're that mother who hits, grabs, pushes, or jerks your child around, I don't want to know you. If you spank your kids, we probably have nothing in common. If you say mean, hurtful things to your kids, I don't want to hear it, and I don't want to be around it." Given her own sensitivity to being judged, it would be easy to label her criticisms of others as self-righteousness. But I'm not sure that's accurate, at least not in this example. I saw fear and shame more than anger. This is the vicious cycle. The judgment of others leaves us feeling hurt and ashamed, so we judge others as a way to make ourselves feel better. As I interviewed more and more women about this phenomenon, I realized that to move away from judging, we must be very mindful of what we are thinking, feeling, and saying. You can't fake non-judgment. It's in our eyes, our voices, and our body language. Real empathy requires us to stay out of judgment, and that's very difficult if we are not self-aware. We must know and understand ourselves before we can know and understand someone else. To understand another person's feelings. In order to do this, we must be in touch with our own feelings and emotions, and we need to be comfortable in the larger world of emotion and feelings. For many, this world is completely foreign. It's a complex world of new language and thinking. For example, if we can't recognize the subtle but important differences between disappointment and anger in ourselves, it's virtually impossible to do with others. If we can't recognize and name fear when we are feeling it, how will we empathically connect to someone else who is in fear? Emotions are difficult to recognize and even harder to name. This is especially true if we weren't given the vocabulary and skills required to navigate this emotional world when we were growing up, which unfortunately is the case for most of us. In the example with Dawn, she made it clear to me that she knew what I was feeling when she said, "You're just trying to hold it together," and, "I know you don't think you're going to make it." She didn't have to say, "I hear that you're experiencing high levels of anxiety coupled with fear of disappointing others." She could have said that. She's a social worker. But she didn't need to. And I'm not even sure that it would have felt as powerful to me. What she did need to do was convey to me that she understood my perspective and my feelings about the situation. To communicate your understanding of that person's feelings. For me, this last step can sometimes feel risky. I know that when I teach empathy skills to graduate students, this is often where they stumble, where we all stumble. Let's imagine that Dawn misunderstood my feelings, or didn't fully get my perspective, and her response was more along the lines of, "I know, it's so frustrating. Steve could have remembered to bring those damn cookies to school. Why do we have to remember everything?" Would that have permanently damaged this opportunity for an empathic exchange? Absolutely not. Again, empathy isn't just about the words. It's about fully engaging with someone and wanting to be understood. If I knew that Dawn was engaged, but missing my point, I probably would have said something like, "No, I'm not pissed off at Steve. I'm freaking out because I screwed up, and this weekend hasn't even started yet." Now, if Dawn had not been engaged, and had not really been listening, I might not have bothered to stay connected and to keep seeking what I needed from her. I might have just accepted her comment about Steve and said, "Yeah, the pressure is all on mothers," and moved on. But when I told her that it wasn't funny, she got very quiet, and I knew she was listening and wanted to hear me. Empathy, courage, and compassion. Stories require voices to speak them and ears to hear them. Stories only foster connection when there is both someone to speak and someone to listen. In sharing my work on women and shame, I hope to accomplish two things: give voice to the voiceless and give ears to the earless. My first goal is to share the complex and important stories that women often keep to themselves because of shame. I want to share these voices because their stories are our stories. They deserve to be told. My second goal is to relay these stories in a way that allows us to hear them. Often the problem isn't with the voices, but rather with our ears. The voices are frequently there, singing, screaming, yearning to be heard. But we don't hear them because fear and blame muffle the sounds. Courage gives us a voice, and compassion gives us an ear. Without both, there is no opportunity for empathy and connection. Again, I'm not talking about bravery or heroics. I'm talking about ordinary courage. The courage to tell our story from the heart. It took courage to call Dawn and tell her about the cookies. Dawn had to practice compassion. She had to be willing to make room in her world for my painful experience. In the next two sections, we'll explore these ideas of courage and compassion separately. but I first wanted to emphasize the importance of how they work together. Empathy and courage. In the introduction, I talked about the important history of the word courage. While it's certainly not unusual for the meanings of words to change over time,